This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
So, thank you, everybody. I don't know how I can do both at once. Let's start by handing these out, if we could. And I also brought this in case you want to be in touch or have information. So I do appreciate getting the chance to learn with you. I'm going to get on a lazy Susan so I can spin around and see everybody. And I wanted us to talk about something that leaped out at me in the text. And that is the question of what is our role in shaping God's identity? So on the one hand, that's a little abstract, but I think there are some strong implications. Do you think about the divine as malleable? Is God capable of changing, or is God timeless, static, beyond human capacity to intervene? And in a sense, that's also a question about how do you understand the cosmos? Do you understand the universe to be dynamic and relational and changing? Or do you understand there to be a kind of underlying, unchanging oneness? For those of you who do philosophy, this is really asking you, are you a Platonist or not? Right? Platonists like to see everything stay the same. They like eternal, timeless verities. And then they remake God in that image too. So I'm not here taking a stand one way or the other. But when I stumbled across these Midrashic texts, I was intrigued by the way, at the very least, a part of rabbinic tradition is asking us to step into a place in which we have a responsibility for God's education. And religious Jews don't generally talk that way, right? We don't think of ourselves as having a role in what does God know about the world and how does God process the world and can we teach God to do a better job? That's really the question. So I want us to have a discussion about that, but I want to frame it around the text, right? And while we're looking at the text, I want you to be thinking about your own personal understanding, right? And if it's too difficult to think about, do you have a role in teaching God, then how about you think about, do you have a role in shaping Judaism? Is Judaism a timeless body of doctrine and practice, and your job is to just get with the program and not mess with it? Or are you somehow expected to leave Judaism better than you found it, right? And that's in sense, whether your life is a success as a Jew or not, is the Judaism at the time of your death better than the Judaism at the time of your life, in part because of you, right? So that's the kind of questions I want to be thinking about, and I am going to ask for your engagement in this in a moment, but I think it's best to do it through text. So very much in the spirit of the Pardes Beit Midrash, we're going to have an interesting conversation stimulated by text. So we're starting on the page that says 1 at the bottom. That's an indication that that's the first page. And I'm hoping someone would be willing to volunteer to read the text from Brachot. You can read it in either one of the two languages in front of you. Someone want to read it for us? Thank you. Okay, great. So let's go over that for a minute. God says, I have pardoned according to your word. What's the piece that the rabbis are picking up on? There's something in the text that's going to spark them to have this conversation. What part of the text are they jumping on? Kidvarecha. Correct. So what does it mean to say I pardon according to your word? That's not really how we expect God to operate. We would expect God to say, I'm pardoning because I, God, have decided that's the thing to do. So since every word of the Torah is pregnant with multiple meaning and with deep meaning, there's got to be something in there that we're supposed to learn. And so that's what the rest of the conversation will be. And so there's this conversation that takes place in the school of Rabbi Ishmael. Many of you, I assume, have already learned that there are two great bodies approaching Jewish text in the rabbinic period, the school of Rabbi Ishmael and the school of Rabbi Akiva. At some point in your life, you should read Abraham Joshua Heschel's greatest book, Torah Min HaShemayim Bas Baklari Shel HaDorot, which, thank God, was translated into beautiful English by Gordon Tucker as Heavenly Torah. It's Heschel's magisterial presentation of the differences and overlap between the schools of Rabbi Ishmael and Rabbi Akiva. This is Rabbi Ishmael, and he's now saying, here's what it means, that someday the world is going to say, happy the disciple to whom the master concedes. Who's the master and who's the disciple in that? Yeah? Right? So the disciple is Moshe. Right? And the master? The master is Hashem. Right? So look at the notion here is that it's good for the disciple to have a Rav, a master, who is willing to admit mistake. So the first question I want to ask you is that true? Yeah? We're all in agreement about that. We want to be serving a master who's able to say, I didn't know what I was doing until you told me. No, thank you. So, right? It's a little problematic, isn't it? Right? You come to Pardes and the teacher say, gee, I never understood these texts until you said something about it. Well, then what am I paying all the money and living all the way here for? I could do that at home. Right? So already, through the eyes of Rabbi Ishmael's school, their understanding of the divine is that perfection doesn't mean unchanging. Perfection doesn't mean all-knowing. Right? God's greatness is his capacity to learn. That's what God is infinite about. God can learn infinitely. And Moses is capable of teaching him. Right? And then it goes even further. They take this pasuk from Bamidbar, V'ulam Cheani, nevertheless as I live, and they take that last to Cheani, and they play with it to say that Moses' teaching is what vivifies God. Anybody want to respond to that or react to that? It's Moses' insight that makes God live? Yeah. Great.
But if you can see that God is learning and able to learn, then all the other times when God has authority and is saying something really strongly, you can all the more so that it's going to authoritative.
Okay, so one way, and I like that, is that it adds to God's authority because when Moses says yes to something, God can know that he means it because occasionally Moses says no, right? I think that's true, yeah. Great. So I just want to tweak that a little bit. I want to include moms and daughters in that conversation and say that, because, you know, sometimes they're impressive too. So the Talmud, interestingly enough, says that there are two groups for whom one does not feel jealousy. Right? You don't feel jealous of your children and you don't feel jealous of your students. Right, I've been in the rabbi training business long enough. This is my 18th year. I have rabbis out in the world who I remember their Israel year. Many of them started in this Beit Midrash. And now I see them doing incredible things that I would never have thought of. And whereas I might feel jealous if a colleague does that, when my students do it, I'm just happy. Right? So yeah, so Moses and God have that kind of relationship. And maybe it makes God happy when Moses is able to think of something that God couldn't. Yeah. Yeah. I can hear the upset in your voice, and I get that, right? So to the extent that we think of God's sovereignty as absolute and unchanging, then the notion that we make God sovereign is really problematic, right? And that is exactly the same problem here. So you're right to locate the two as the same. I think it is the same idea. Yeah. Great. Why listen to anyone who's not always right? So I'm going to make you answer that question.
That's not exactly what I'm saying, but I think, like, with what authority does God speak if we decide what he thinks?
I know. So you tell me.
I don't know.
Your teachers, are they always right?
No.
With what authority? So why listen to them at all? Right.
Essentially, God is teaching some ideas, some of which are good and some of which are bad, and we get to decide.
That from your tone, I can tell that you're thinking the answer should be no, but I'm thinking the answer should be yes. That's exactly right. Not only that, but I think that's what the Gemara is telling you should be our response. Right? Meaning, what's being proposed here is that our receiving the tradition should not be passive. Our receiving the tradition should be evaluative. Is this a good idea or not? Does this work or not? What can that possibly mean in our context, in our world? The notion that the Torah just drops on us and we go do it neutrally, I think they're asking for a much more engaged involvement, which means, yeah, that we are analyzing and evaluating every piece of the Masorah. Look, the responsibility to do that well means you have to learn at a very high level. Because if you're going to evaluate, you'd better know how it plays out and how others have heard it. But once you've done that, your job isn't just to memorize what a lot of dead people said. Right? Your job is to make it live. And that's scary. Right? That's the part that's disturbing. Because in some ways, it's much more comforting to think all I need to do is learn the Torah other people have brought into the world and then apply it. And then I'm finished. Right? But this is asking for something much less stable than that. This is asking, you got a job to do. Yeah.
I think what is troubling is we're equating God with the Masorah. That whatever tradition we've received is essentially the same thing as God, and we're not drawing the same conclusion.
Okay, so what would happen if we did? Play that out for me. And would that be more comforting? We're only all of us speaking for ourselves. Okay, so some, and by the way, that's a common way to protect Hashem, right? The part that I don't understand is the implied frailty, but we protect God by saying, well, God is always perfect, we just misunderstood it, right? And you would not be the first Jew to do that. So you're standing with very noble lineage. Yeah. Okay, fine. So you're just a more noble soul than I am, or you're doing a better job of cleaning it up. But the statement that we're not protecting God, we're protecting us because it's just to live in a universe that isn't being governed by someone perfect. I don't know correctly. All I have is access to the way I see things. I actually feel liberated by this Gemara, right? The idea that, I mean, first of all, if God is actually all-knowing and all-powerful, then God is the greatest underachiever in the history of the cosmos, right? Because, frankly, you know, just take a look outside. But I love the idea that God learns from experience. Well, here's a bottom line I want to share with you. You can't enter into relationship if you're not willing to change because of the relationship, right? You should, by the way, take that into your romantic lives, right? It's completely true. Years ago, I was a pulpit rabbi, and I was counseling a guy who was going through his fourth divorce. Right, this was the fourth wife who was leaving him. And he said to me, Rabbi, I know as a matter of fact that this time it wasn't my fault because I haven't changed a bit since the day I met her. Right? So in a sense, we're saying that about God. But if you think God is in relationship with the Jewish people and being relationship is being willing to change because of the relationship, then you're saying God is changing. Right? We change God. God changes us. For some people, admittedly, that's very unsettling. I find that really liberating. I want a God I can love, right? And I want a God who works with me, right? So, okay, so let's move on. And the question I want us to keep thinking about, and I want you to think about this, is can your Torah revivify God, right? Do we make a difference? Are we a benefit to God? So let's go on. Someone want to read the next one, the second paragraph from Bamidbar Rabbah on the bottom of the page? It's still on page one. Yes, sir.
Another explanation of the text, then saying Israel, this is one of the three things said by Moses, the holy blessing on which God replied. You have taught me something. Moses said to God, sovereign of the universe, how can Israel realize what they have done? Were they not reared up in Egypt? And are not all the Egyptian worshippers of idols? Moreover, when you gave the Torah, you did not give it to them. They were not even standing nearby. As it says, the people stood afar off. You gave it only to me. As it says, to Moses, he said, come up unto the Holy One. When you gave the commandments, you didn't give it to them. You did not say, I'm the Lord, Lord all y'all's God. But I'm the Lord your God. You said it to me. Have I sinned? By your life, said the Holy Blessing of Moses. You have spoken well. You have taught me something. From now onward, I shall use the expression, I'm the Holy One, all y'all's God.
Beautifully read. The English translation is brought to you by the great state of Texas because in contemporary English, there is no second person plural except in Texas and in Brooklyn. You could say you guys or all y'all. Right? So look at what Moses is saying to God. Right? Moses is saying here that you can't blame the Jews for their constant backsliding. Right? For two reasons. What are the two reasons? Yeah. Yeah, look at the neighborhood they were in, for God's sake. You know, they're raised with a bunch of Avodah Zarah nicks, so what do you expect from them? Right, they reflect the culture that they were steeped in. So you can't hold them accountable for that. You should have put them in a better neighborhood, right? And reason number two, why God can't blame the Israelites? Correct, because the Torah wasn't given to them, right? God goes out of God's way to not give it to them. God says, have the people stand far off the mountain. And then God speaks directly to Moses, and he says, I'm giving this to you, and tell the Jewish people. So everything gets reported through Moses, but none of it is direct encounter. And when he reports it to them, he reports it as though God is commanding Moses, not God is commanding them. So naturally, they're going to think, what does this have to do with me? Right? And Moses chews out God for that choice. Right? Both choices in a sense, right? You should never have sent them to Mitzrayim, and God, you're revealing Torah wrong. That's a big chutzpah thing, right? Notice Moses is the one who's now equating God and the Masorah. Right? And God says, you're right. You're right. So from now on, when I give you a command, it's going to be a command to the Jewish people. and I'm going to use the plural language so that they know it's about them. All right, so what do you think about that? What do you do with that?
That appeals more to me, personally.
Okay.
I'm much more interested in my bad Israel than my own personal God. And now, I don't know how it would be true for the Bnei Israel back in the desert, but if they were used to a national cult of gods in Egypt, right, like, it's true that they may have had personal houses of gods, but they're also going to be used to Osiris being the god of all of Egypt. So I don't know if it's necessarily the case that that's really what the problem was.
Okay, so I want to translate that language to reveal a couple ideas that I think are buried in it, right? So when you say really, I think what you mean is historically, right? And it is clear that the Darshan here is messing with the text, right? Because nowhere does it imply that God is saying, here, Moses, I'm commanding you personally all this stuff, right? And so those of us reading Sefer Shemot, we automatically hear it as speaking to the Jewish people as an entity. The Darshan knows that, but he wants to make a point.
I mean, I know the Darshan knows that, but my point is that maybe, like, he can be suggesting that, he could reasonably suggest in here that, like, Bnei Israel would do better with getting their own personal God. Maybe, like, everyone had, right, like, there's this idea that, like, the Torahs have many faces, so that everyone can relate to something.
Yes.
But maybe it's okay to have a God who is for the God of Israel. Not
correct, but I don't think that's the alternative he's putting out here. I think what he's saying is the alternative is God the God of all of Israel, or is God the God of Moses? That's the conflict, right? And by the way, if I can add a historical piece, in ancient Near Eastern religions, as in most non-Israelite ancient religions, the gods are uninterested in the people, right? The gods of Babylonia speak to the nobility of Babylonia, and then the Babylonian people are servants of the nobility doing the schmutz work in the temple, right? They're feeding the gods, clothing the gods. That's what, so religion wasn't about Amcha, right? So in that sense, I think that's the dynamic underneath this. Is God really addressing Am Yisrael? And if so, God needs to use second person plural. Not so that each of us have our own individual God, but so that each of us know that God is addressing us through Am Yisrael, but God is interested in us too, not just our leaders. Right? Okay, what else? Anyone else? Yeah. Well, is Az Yashir happening now, or is it happening in the future? Right? The language sounds like it's saying, then they will sing. So I think that's what's sparking the drash. Right? As opposed to they're singing now, then they will sing. You talk to them, they'll sing fine. Don't keep talking to me. My son Jacob is autistic, and he communicates with facilitated communication, so he does assisted typing. And whenever he, that means I'm often facilitating his typing, and he'll ask a question, and then whoever is standing there will answer me. And I have to say, no, 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 I wasn't asking you that question. That was him. I'm just the typist. Right? So I have a thing. Moses is saying that to God. You know, you want to talk to them? Talk to them. I'll stand here, but you're talking to them. Others. Yeah.
It sounds to me like the Darshan is emphasizing Israel.
Yeah. Great. Okay.
Because, well, God doesn't say, well, you should reread what you're saying. He's saying, well, from now on,
right.
I've written it down.
That's right.
But from now on,
correct.
I, who am still acting in real time post Chumash, I'm
going to. Awesome. Well, not just post Chumash, but post this moment in Chumash.
Yeah.
Right? I'm going to start using second plural to move forward.
Oh, wow.
That's yes. Immediate response. It's a good thing in a God. Okay. All right, so you're all good. Anything else you want to say about this paragraph? Can we just point out what kind of chutzpah this is? You know, that Moses' response to God's revelation is, excuse me, I don't mean to be rude or anything, but God, you're revealing Torah wrong. And here's really how you should be revealing it. And God's response is not, you know, the earth swallows him up, right? Or, you know, look who's criticizing me. God's response is, you're right, I'm going to change it. So I just want to hold out to you that's a very different model of greatness, right? I love the God who can say, you're right, I'm going to take your suggestion and I'm going to do better now. That to me is greatness, yeah. I don't. So here's what I want to invite you to try to do. Don't flatten Midrashim into a single distilled lesson. Right? If Judaism wanted to do that, it would have. I don't think the rabbis are interested in a single coherent message. I think they're interested in giving you the truth in every scenario. And as you know, I assume from your own life, we are all of us a jumble of incompatible truths, all of which have some truth in them. That's the genius of the Midrashic approach, right? The Agadita has room for highlighting the truth of this moment, right? So plenty of, you know, you look at the Midrashim in a sense as the sermon notes of whoever's the Darshan, right? And this week what the Kahal needs to learn is to be better behaved in shul and have some manners and keep quiet during the Torah reading. But next week, I'm going to chew you out for not greeting visitors to the synagogue. And you're going to say, wait, Rabbi, last week you told me I'm supposed to sit passively. Yes, because last week that's what you needed to learn. And this week you need to learn to get out of your seat and welcome people. Right? So don't worry about homogenizing Dreshot. Let it be. All right, we ready for the next one? Page 2. I'm looking for a volunteer. A loud volunteer. Yes.
The second occasion was when the Holy Blessed One said to Moses, visiting the iniquity of the parents upon the children. Moses said to him, Sovereign of the universe, many are the wicked who have begotten righteous children. Shall the latter bear some of the iniquities of their parents? Terah worshipped images, yet Abraham was his son was righteous. Similarly, Hezekiah was righteous, though Ahaz his father was wicked. So also Josiah was righteous, yet Amon his father was wicked. And this proper, that the righteous should be punished for the iniquity of their parents, the Holy Blessing One said to Moses, You have taught me something. By your life I shall cancel my words and confirm yours. As it says, the parents shall not be put to death for their children, neither shall their children be put to death for the parents. And by your life I shall record these words in your name, as it says, according to that which is written in the book of the laws of Moses,
beautifully read. Thank you. Okay, I love this. I love this. So God's busy revealing Torah, and it does say in the book of Exodus that children are held accountable for the iniquity, the sinfulness of their parents, yea, even to the third and fourth generations. Right? So, okay, that's the rule. You're responsible for the sins of your parents. Right? And what's Moses' response? It's not fair. Right? Punish the parents for their own iniquity, fine. But, you know, nobody should have to be responsible for their relatives. Right? Which I think is a good rule in general. Right? So no one should have to do that. And then he uses as examples three different cases of righteous children of iniquitous parents. And says, you shouldn't be punishing them for their parents. If anything, I think what's implied here is righteous children of iniquitous parents deserve extra credit. Right? If you're able to grow up in that household and still be a mensch, then kol hakavod, really, more power to you. That's awesome. Right? And God's response is, you've taught me something. Right? You've taught me something. I won't do that again. And What's the scriptural basis for that understanding? What allows them to say God learned from Moses in that instance? Which is found where in Scripture? No, you went too far. Deuteronomy. So here's, Michael Fishbane wrote a brilliant book about in biblical interpretation within the Bible. So in a sense, Midrash is not a rabbinic activity. Midrash is a biblical activity in which later biblical authors riff on the writings of earlier biblical authors. For those of you who accept documentary hypothesis, right? For those of you who don't, but then you just say it differently. Right? So this is an example of an internal to the Chumash evolution of Torah. Right? In Shemot, which is an earlier source, L'chol Deot, in Shemot, there's a sense that it's fair to blame children for their parents because our identities are not as distinct individuals. We are all of us part of this flow called Israel. And so we benefit from that flow and we pay a price for that flow. Right? So that's the, but by Devarim already, people have a sense that's not right. You don't punish people for the stuff that other people do. Right? And so Devarim's pasuk is in flat contradiction to Shemot. Right? The Midrash is noticing that and they're saying that's an example of God saying, I was wrong. I'm going to learn from you and not do it. The genius of the Midrashist is to put that argument into Moses' mouth, right? So in a sense, this is an answer to the question of why does Devarim contradict Shemot? And the answer is they make up a dialogue between Moses and God in which Moses chews God out and God says, got it, you're right, I'll get it right now. Okay? And then he goes one step further. God says, not only will I now teach it your way, but what is the Jewish ethos about teaching something that someone else taught you? Pardon me? It's B'Shem Omro. You're supposed to cite the name of who you learned it from. So later in Tanakh, indeed, it is cited not as God's teaching, but as Moses'. I want to point out how brilliantly the Darshan knows Scripture. Right? You have to know Scripture well to be able to make this double play. Right? But it's exactly right that it's called the Book of the Law of Moses, which you'd think it was the Book of the Law of God. Right? Why does Moses get the credit? Because he's the one that thought of it, and then God said, okay, I'm going to do it your way. So he cites the author. Right? I love that. Okay? All right, and then the third time that God learned something from Moses. Someone want to read the last paragraph? Oh, wait, I have one other thing to say. This is purely extra, no extra charge here. While you are in Jerusalem, you should go to the Israel Museum. They used to have, I think they still have, a little tiny silver scroll that has Birkat Kohanim carved into it. It's from Ketef Chinom, which is under St. Andrew's Church. There was a first temple burial site there from the time of King Hezekiah. That's the Hezekiah the Righteous here. That's what reminded me to tell you this. You got to go see it. It's astonishing. It's one of the oldest fragments of Bible in the world. A blessing that I give to my children every single Shabbat. And some Yid 800 BCE was so moved by that he had it carved in silver and then he rolled it around his neck and was buried wearing it. You realize what a privilege it is to be part of a continuous culture in which we're still saying the same prayers in the same language to the same God in the same place. Nobody else in the world gets that. It's astonishing. You should just go there and you should look at that silver foil until it sinks into your soul. Okay, that's King Hezekiah. Okay, last paragraph. Just one more volunteer. Yes, sir.
Rise up, take a journey, and pass over the valley of Ono, and contend with Sikon and Reuben.
Beautiful. Thank you. So notice that the first command is, I want you to go do battle with these people. And there's no offering of peace. There's no preliminary negotiations. It's just go do it. And Moses refuses to do that. Moses sends messengers ahead. The rabbinic understanding is that those messengers were sent to negotiate peace. And God likes Moses' approach. So God says, okay, I get it. I'm going to do it your way from now on. And that's why the second pasuk in Devarim tells us that when you approach a city to fight, first proclaim peace. And only if that doesn't work do you then actually fight. Now, I want to ask you cumulatively, what do you do? Three occasions in the Midrash where God is portrayed as saying, you were right and I was wrong. And I want to ask you on two levels. I want to ask you in terms of Jewish culture, what do you do with a rabbinic civilization that wants you to understand the divine in terms of conceding when wrong and publicly acknowledging that and modifying? What are we supposed to learn from that? And then the last question I want to ask as a rabbi to you, if you think that's true, does God actually learn from us? Those are two separate questions, but they play into each other, yeah. Beautiful. That's a great insight. You weren't too cynical until that paper over crack, but then you did go over the line. So why does it have to be one or the other? Like maybe the Darshan is dealing with what we would see as proto-biblical criticism, but at the same time, it's either the price to pay or the benefit of this is the notion of an evolving God. Well, and of the readers too, right? So we can't ultimately, we don't have access to the mind of the Darshan. We just have the Midrash. So we can look at our own way. But I will tell you, from my perspective, this isn't an exception to rabbinic literature. Rabbinic literature is premised on the notion that it is possible for the divine will to shift, right? It's why Hilchata Kevatrai, you know, the latest authority is the dominant one, right? And we do that because we can understand better. But that, if you think that halakha is always God's will, then you're saying that God's will is shifting over time, right? So I think this gives a grounding for that. I don't know that that's cynical. I suppose it depends on how committed you are to a timeless, powerful God. Okay, so back to the questions. What do you do with this teaching culturally in Jewish civilization, and then do you think this is in fact how God operates in the world? Yeah. Excellent. So in rabbinic texts, there are always two ways you can read, at least. One is a conservative way and one is a liberal way. So that story that someone alluded to about Moshe in the back row of Rabbi Akiva's classroom, you can read that in a liberal way or in a conservative way. Either it means that anything any rabbi teaches today was already given at Sinai, or it means only the stuff that was given at Sinai can a rabbi teach today. You can do either way, and the story doesn't tell you how to go. So one way to read this would be to say, yeah, okay, fine, between Moses and God, God does that, but let me tell you, you're no Moses. Right? That's a perfectly legitimate thing to get out of this. And here, I can't step outside of my own skin, right? I think the rabbis are inviting us to be in touch with our inner Moshe, right? That's a Hasidic strategy in reading texts, is that you see yourself as all the characters in the story, which, by the way, means you also see yourself as the Ribono Shel Olam. But if we're getting in touch with our inner Moshe, then in a sense this story is giving us permission to be able to say, with all due regard, I think the Masorah is wrong here, or there's a better way to accomplish the goal. Right? And that's, I think, what it's inviting us to. But admittedly, you could go either way with the text. So, which way do you go? Okay. Others, what do you do with this? Yeah. Great. So I want to highlight what was just said, because I think it's really important, right? To the extent that we are all of us in relationships in which we are God to someone else, right? We're in that dominant role, that being open to learning from them, that's a little bit different than leaving the table a mess so they can clean it up. Correct, but this is saying something stronger than that, which is you're in the middle of making dinner and your child walks in and says, Ima, there's a better way to make it. Let me show you, right? And the response in this midrash would be not to say, look, I've been cooking dinners for X number of years. Don't tell me, but to say, okay, show me, right? And inviting the child to rise in leadership and rise in initiative. And I agree. I think that Rabbinic Judaism at its best is a steady invitation for us to rise in holiness by owning the Masorah, right? And this is a bunch of stories saying, this is your tradition, so own it, which means how it gets read is your responsibility, and what lessons you derive from it, that's your responsibility, and what Judaism ends up teaching, that's partly your responsibility too, right? And so that's our own spiritual growth depends on it, and God's prepared to concede, I didn't think about that until you did. Excellent. So if God can be wrong, then alachat kama v'chama us, right? So part of what becomes possible in a model in which God admits to error is you're not losing anything when you do the same, right? In a world in which perfection is never being wrong, then I think that makes it harder publicly to say, ooh, I need to learn, I need to change, right? But this model holds out that from the very top, we all of us make mistakes, and we all of us need to learn, which means we need to do that too.
I would actually push back on that, because I think that there is actually a greater stake on you if you get it wrong, because you need to also have the stat. You need to have, like, you need to have chutzpah, but you need to have the stature to have chutzpah b'shem shemayim. If you don't actually have that stature, then your chutzpah may be misled necessarily.
Okay, good. So I think the Gemara says that elsewhere when it says it's easier to issue an isur than a heter, right? Any ignoramus can say, no, that's not permissible. But it takes someone who actually knows the details of the law to be able to say, yep, that's permissible, right? And I think that's the same point you're making, right? Which is the burden then on us is to make sure we actually know what we're talking about. Yeah. Why are you guys afraid of being cynical?
We just don't want to think of rejection
How are you reading that out of this midrash? I'm not following. Got it. Okay, that's a great reading. I only have one little technical footnote to add to that. This is located as the school of Rabbi Ishmael. I don't think the Ishmaelites thought that it was literally the words of God. I think they were the ones who said God can't talk, right? That talking is a human activity. The Akivans love to do stuff like that, but not the Ishmaelites. So I think they actually probably didn't have that sense. Right? Yeah. Great.
Which is to say that it's the Darshan's job to, like, to be looking at, like, changes between Pasukim in a way that Moshe himself isn't so much. He's, as you say, sort of chewing out God for making error. Right, but it's, the Darshan seems to be observing something.
Mm-hmm.
Right, to saying, oh, look at this contrast. Here's how I can account for it. That doesn't sound. It's clever, but it's not, and it may be revolutionary in a way, but it's not trying to topple anything. It's not trying to overturn something in Torah. It's observing something.
Correct. I guess what I think is revolutionary, and again, there's no way for me to get out of my skin here. I think a Torah that is supple and capable of generating new interpretations is one that has a greater capacity to survive than a Torah that always means the same thing throughout all time. So what the Darshan is doing is not only revivifying God, but Torah as well. All right, if I can give you an analogy, in the United States, we have this Constitution. The reason we have the oldest Constitution in the world, I'm not going partisan here. The reason we have that old Constitution is because it turns out that the Constitution de facto means whatever the Supremes say it means. Right? And because they have the power to do that, to reinterpret it authoritatively, if we were stuck with what the Constitution meant when it was first written, we would have had to get rid of it a long time ago. Right? And I think what they're holding up, what the Darshan here is suggesting, is similarly with Torah. It's because the Torah is supple and capable of reinterpreting, that's what allows it to remain a living Torah. Yes?
So the title here is "Our Torah Can Revive God," the implication being that God is dead without this relationship. Or at least dormant without this relationship. And I worry that that's quite a strong consequence of this overall thesis, is that if people aren't engaging with this relationship, then he's dead. And are you willing to accept that for the sake of the whole idea? I don't know.
Well, it depends on what you mean. Look, so when you say that, there's something metaphorical about God being alive or dead, right? God doesn't have a pulse. So when you say God's alive, you're engaging in a metaphor. Okay? So I'm not sure what the alarm is. And frankly, the title is quoting God. So if you want to take this up with God, God's the one who turns to Moses and says, "You have revived me." Revive is the same thing. So what I want to ask you back is the same question. Are you prepared to conceive of the divine as radically separate from and external to creation? And I think that many Jews say yes to that because they think they have to. But I don't think it comes from Jewish sources. I don't think the Tanakh or the Talmud do that. I think that that comes out of a bad application of Greek thought. So, yeah, I'm very happy to live with the notion, and maybe a better word than the opposite of revive is dead, is maybe we energize God, right? Maybe we bring vitality to God, and otherwise God is just nothing but infinite potential. And that may be fine, but it's not very exciting. So in the same way that someone referred to the Machzor's line that, you know, we make God king, because you can't be king if you don't have a kingdom. So it's our willingness to be God's subjects that allows God to be the monarch, right? Maybe in the same way, our willingness to enter into the kind of open engagement in which we and God really talk to each other, maybe that's what fully allows God to be God. I'm willing to live with that. I didn't say just.
Okay, it's a metaphor.
Yeah.
So, okay, so it's a metaphor, but that doesn't negate Jake's question.
So.
I'm interested in an answer to his question. I don't think.
So, what's the question?
Maybe dead or alive isn't the right word, but exist or not exist.
Oh, but okay, so I don't think that this is saying that God ceases to be if we freeze the Torah and we either walk away from it or not. I don't think that's the opposite of revive. When you say you've revived me, you know, I'm engaged, I'm alive, I'm connected. I think that's what it's asking. I can best answer this in Kabbalah, right? So we can't relate to Ein Sof, but the status of Ein Sof is untouched by what we do. On the other hand, Ein Sof doesn't much matter in the world because its very ungraspable and unchanging nature makes it off limits. The God that we connect to is the God of the Sefirot, and that God is absolutely impacted by our choices. Right? So there is, I believe, a manifestation of the divine that is beyond space and time, that is eternal and changeless. But that manifestation of God, that aspect of God, is relatively trivial within creation because it's timeless and eternal and whatever. That manifestation of God that impacts us is the dynamic and immanent aspect of God, and that is vivified or not by our choices. Did that answer the question? Okay. Well, bring in a high-paid speaker and maybe they can answer better. That's the best I can do. You get what you pay for. Other thoughts about this notion that what we do can energize the divine? Yeah. Yes.
So the fact is that it's just one way, it's not like the only way.
For sure. Okay, so very important point. Look, Judaism is not, as I said about the Midrash before, Judaism isn't a single authorized view, right? Lots of very learned Jews have had lots of different ways of taking the tradition and understanding it. So there are certainly very learned Jews who would stand here and say, Judaism teaches that God never changes, that God is all-knowing and all-powerful and all-good, and doesn't need your prayers and doesn't need your observance. Maimonides, among them, would say that, right? But there are a whole lot of Jews, including Rav Sadia, and I think the Talmud and the Bible, and the Kabbalists and the Hasidim, who have a very dynamic notion of the divine as absolutely impacted and implicated by our choices and our behavior, right? You need to be sending back energy from the broken vessels back to God every Shabbos, right? So you're literally rebuilding the divine. That has deep roots. And I think it's a more promising part of our tradition. But that's a personal bias. You don't have to believe that or anything I said. Yes.
Bread, etc. And then when the king comes back, says to the servant with the pile of wheat, like, I don't want a pile of wheat. I don't know what you're doing with this. Which is then like used as a metaphor.
Correct. So, you know, that metaphor is a little bit different than this one because it doesn't change the status of God, right? What you don't do is have a servant who says to God, you know, no, I refuse to enter into this. What I did instead was I spent the time learning to read Russian so I could get through War and Peace. Let me read to you. That would be an interesting take on it. And then God said, yeah, that's better than playing with wheat. Okay. But yes, certainly insofar as Torah tradition is understood, the notion that your job is to just hold on to what you received and do nothing with it, that midrash is on the side of no, your job is to make it better. And in that sense, it is absolutely compatible to this. All right, I know you guys are pressed for time, so thank you very much. It's really a privilege and a pleasure to learn with you. I hope that the rest of your time here is fruitful and full of insight and full of blessing, and that you emerge from the year greater and more passionate and more devoted in however you understand it.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.